As a sports scientist, we often got chatting about the questions that need answering, and as any sport and any coach want to be able to predict talent, right? They want the magic bullet, which I don't think exists. Historically, as sports scientists and practitioners, we're really very poor at predicting talent.
So welcome, Vicky, to Evidence Strong Show. It's my pleasure to have you. And if you could briefly introduce yourself, that would be great.
Hi Alex, thanks very much for talking to me today about the paper. So I'm Vicky Gottwald. Just to give you a bit of brief background, I suppose I wear a few different hats. So firstly, I'm a lecturer at Bangor University, so you should be able to see the picture of a bit of a Hogwarts building in the background. So I lecture, my expertise is in skill acquisition. So I have a coaching background, and I have probably have two streams of research. One is to do with coaching instruction, specifically in terms of internal and external focus of attention. I won't get into that too much today. But then the other stream of research is a bit more applied in terms of talent development. And I work with a number of UK sporting governing bodies, Weightlifting Wales, Welsh Rowing, and then I have some projects with UK Sport and some of their pathway sports as well, which is where this project comes into play. And then I'm also have a so the reason one of the reasons I'm interested in skill acquisition is because I have a coaching background. So basketball was my background. I'm a level four coach, and I've done a lot of coaching with the Basketball Wales national team programs from sort of junior to senior. And then I suppose more recently I've stepped away from playing, I've stepped away from coaching, and then I've just got a bit more into the performance strategy and leadership side of sports. So I'm also the talent identification and transfer lead on something called WIPS, which is the Welsh Institute of Performance Sciences. So essentially it's a three-way partnership between higher education institutions in Wales, Sport Wales, which is our national sporting governing body, and then industry, so individual sporting governing bodies, and just to try and answer the questions, I suppose, that are important for sporting governing bodies, answer the questions that they want answering. So we're not just doing research for the sake of research. And then I'm also a board director as part of Weightlifting Wales. That happened after this research, and I'll do a little bit of help in terms of Basketball Wales performance strategies as well. I don't think I've missed anything. That gives you a bit of an idea of a few different hats I wear.
So today we'll be talking about the paper titled "A Retrospective Inquiry into the Holistic Development of Elite British Olympic Weightlifters." So I think it will be good to start with what was the study about, what participants were recruited, and what was the goal, and then we'll go into the details.
Fantastic. So just to give a bit of context, so this I suppose this started, I used as a basketball player, I used to train in one of the gyms up in North Wales, and the coach there, he was the national team coach for weightlifting, and he used to do a lot of my strength and conditioning. So as a sports scientist, we often got chatting about the questions that need answering, and as any sport and any coach wants to know, they want to be able to predict talent, right? They want the magic bullet, which I don't think exists. Historically, as sports scientists and practitioners, we're really very poor at predicting talent, and we did make that clear with Weightlifting Wales. But we said that we would do what we could do, and have a look into that problem. And really, the timing is quite good, because I don't know, Alex, if you've heard of the Great British, have you come across the Great British Medalist Study? Yeah, so this was work commissioned by UK Sport that Bangor University and a couple of other UK institutions, Exeter and Cardiff Met, had previously been involved in. They started off with a review of current knowledge on the development of the world's best sporting talent. So what makes people great, essentially, and that's from a multidisciplinary perspective. So in terms of anthropometrics, practice hours, psychology, demographics, all of those things. And then that review then informed further studies and one of which was a retrospective study, much like the one that we're going to discuss today, where they took some of the top athletes across the UK system. And what they wanted to do, these athletes were classified as either being super elite or elite. So super elite athletes, they were athletes who were essentially serial medalists across sort of Olympic Games, World Championships. So the ones that had really, really made it. And then the elite athletes were those that they might have had a medal at a World Championships or an Olympics, but they weren't serial medalists. They weren't able to repeat that performance level again. They wanted to know what are the commonalities between these two groups of athletes. So what things are very similar, and then what are the differences between those two groups of athletes? So what are the game changers in determining that sort of super elite element versus elite. So as part of that, they used, one of the studies used machine learning. Again, I'll talk about that in a little bit. They did a fantastic job of identifying some of these important biopsychosocial factors of super elite performance. But there were some limitations, I suppose, with that study. The biggest limitation from our perspective, though, it wasn't sports specific. So we know that what makes a super elite gymnast isn't going to be the same as what makes a super elite swimmer, for example. I'm sure, you know, there's going to be some commonalities, but it's not going to be the same. So we wanted to do a bit of a deep dive just in weightlifting. And then the other issue with that study from our perspective was, or a limitation, I guess, was they looked at practice hours. And they did look at deliberate practice. I think they looked at deliberate practice versus play, but it was a bit of a superficial analysis of the acquisition side of things. And that's really where my interests and my expertise are in. So we wanted to look a bit more about how these athletes were training, what their practice looked like. So in relation to feedback, instruction, the way they structured their practice. So it's a bit more of a deeper dive there. So that was the why. So essentially we replicated some of the GBM research with these quite structured retrospective interview questions. So they took a few hours with athletes that just discussing with athletes their journey. So that was in relation to, we had four developmental themes. So demographics and family. So where they grew up, who their family were, you know, did their family play sport, how many siblings did they have, did they have a, you know, older siblings, younger siblings, same sex, different sex, their sport history, so, you know, what sports did they do growing up, so all these things that we know are important determinants of expertise, and then their weightlifting, a bit more about their weightlifting specific involvement when they started lifting, how much training they did, competitive milestones, so what age were they when they first got selected for an academy, or what age were they when they first got selected for Wales, and so on. And then their weightlifting specific practice activities, which I mentioned earlier in terms of the actual practice they were doing and what that looked like.
What were the participants you recruited? And then we will go into the method, how you collected the data and then analysis.
Okay, great. So what we did is we classified those athletes along with the coaches, or the coaches took the lead on classifying those athletes. Who do they think are the really sort of top level athletes versus those that maybe were excellent athletes, but maybe weren't going to go on to sort of medal at Commonwealth Games or anything. And then the other thing, they, you know, if you look at that statistically, for those people that wanted a bit more of an objective measure of that, the our elite group, they were in the top 20% in terms of their competition performance across the sort of top level competitions. Then they were in that top 20% of athletes, and then the other group were below that. So it was a bit of a combination between of a objective measure and then also that sort of subjective input from coaches, which I think is important as well, to have, you know, to work with them as well.
And were they all at the senior level or younger to you?
Yeah, so these are all senior athletes. So we've actually, at the same time as this study, we almost had a bit of a prospective version of this study running at the same time. But these are athletes that we've already have that outcome. We know that these are the best of the best across British weightlifting, if you like. So they're senior athletes. Athletes that, you know, in some cases have made it. These were current athletes in the Great British Medalist study. They actually used a lot of those athletes were retired. These were still currently performing, but they were athletes that had gone on to make it, if you like, already. So all senior athletes.
How did you collect the data?
So then we carried out these structured interviews, which lasted a few hours, focusing on those four developmental themes, so the demographics and family, sporting history, competitive male milestones, and then their weightlifting specific practice. And then there were two phases of the study, if you like. The first study was using something called machine learning. So for those of you that are not too familiar with data mining processes, it works really well when you've got maybe a small number of participants. So when you don't have huge, you know, we don't have huge numbers of top performing athletes in Wales or even across the UK. So when you've got a lower sample size, perhaps, but when you've got a lot of variables, traditionally in science, we tend to look at relationships between a small number of variables. So, for example, the influence of practice hours on performance, for example. Whereas I suppose we know that sport is a bit more complex than that, and talent is a bit more complex than that. It's dynamic and it's multifaceted. So machine learning is really good when you're trying to look at sort of short fat data sets where you've got small number of athletes, but a high number of variables. You know, I think we had about 1,000 variables in the end. So when you see, so attributes is just another, it's just a terminology. You might see it in pattern recognition, sometimes as features, sometimes as attributes, but we're just talking about variables really, or factors even. So we had our two classes of objects. So the goal of machine learning is to identify these features or attributes that best distinguish between, they call it two classes of objects. So in this case, our two classes of objects is our elite and our sub-elite groups. So is there a pattern of variables that we can use to differentiate between these two groups of athletes to try and answer the question of predicting talent, I suppose, in essence. So that was one side of it, the pattern recognition, trying to identify this pattern that differentiated between these two groups. And then the other side of it, after that, we're able to, and Dior Anderson, he's the first author on this paper, he's the mastermind behind this bit. He used odds ratios, and they're used a lot in the medical field, really. And in short, it's quite a nice metric to assess the likelihood of an athlete attaining elite status based on particular variables or attributes. And it's quite a nice, it gives quite a nice applied finding for coaches, because it will tell you, so for example, it represents the odds of an outcome given the exposure to a particular condition. So for example, one of the things an athlete we found was that an athlete might be, they'll be 9 times more likely to reach that elite status if they're doing 30 minutes of flexibility training a week by age 14. So it's a really nice, simple, applied finding for coaches, so that they can actually embed the findings to improve their pathway. Sometimes in science, we miss that, the findings are not always accessible to coaches. So the odds ratios was quite a nice way to give that a bit of meaning in terms of the for coaches. So what do we need to do with this data? So that worked really well.
The first phase was machine learning, and the outcome of this phase was you've got 6 attributes that were predictive with 86% of accuracy.
Exactly.
What the difference is between sub-elite and elite athlete. And now what happened in the phase two?
So in the phase two, and I'll just mention those 6. So we had this is the interesting bit. So that the amount of weightlifting training they'd done by the age of 12. A really interesting one was the flexibility training. So the elite athletes, the better athletes, were starting flexibility training a bit earlier. By the age of 14, they were doing at least half an hour of flexibility training a week. And then the elite athletes, the better athletes, they were doing some sort of anxiety-specific practice by age 15 as well. And then
could you explain what it is?
Yeah, so basically, and you might have come across representative practice design. We talk about specificity of practice as well, depending on which theoretical underpinnings you have. But essentially, the best practice is practice conditions that replicate that of competition. There's lots of literature which shows the benefits of practicing under a bit of stress, really, some sort of psychological stress, in terms of preparing for future competition, and then also in terms of making sure your practice is representative of the competition environment as well. If we only ever get put under psychological stress when we're under the platform, then performance is going to suffer. So they were trying to replicate, if you, any way of younger athletes can replicate some of the psychological stress in their practice, then that did them really well. And that might be just things like simulating competition, simulating that competition environment in the practice session, things like that. Maybe some sort of consequences, anything like that, just to simulate a bit of psychological stress as well. And then the other one, which was led to some interesting conversations with the coaches, was whole practice. So a lot of coaches are very keen to break down the clean and jerk. It's got those quite distinctive separate movements. So, but actually, especially at the older age groups, they still needed to be doing that whole practice as well of the clean and jerk. And that links as well with your representative practice design literature as well. And then the final one was about international representation levels. So essentially, I think it's just really important that athletes are experiencing competitions early. And then what the second stage of the research, I said we've got these odds ratios, which gives you the odds of an outcome given the exposure to a particular condition. So they just put that into nice terminology for coaches so they could see what that meant. So for example, if an athlete went to at least a continental youth championship representing Wales by 19, then they're sort of almost 17 times more likely incredible. But so it's just making sure, like Weightlifting Wales, they're really trying to make sure athletes are exposed to competition early, and they'll send athletes to that competition when they are young, and they're not necessarily going to medal, but they're going to get that competition experience. So they're really sort of future thinking, looking ahead, even though they might not medal at that event, they're planning for the future. So it just puts that into nice terminology. We talked about the flexibility, and then you can look at the papers for the other odds ratios we've got if you want to know more.
We could go one by one and briefly say what is the likelihood related to each one of them, because I think this is very practical. So if someone they will be like, youth competition, I-19, this is crucial. So it's a lot of aspects. To send a youth athlete to international competition, it's an adventure.
And yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Parents have to agree, school, like this.
It's money as well, especially in terms of the location of some of these competitions. Yeah.
But 17 times, it's way easier choice than saying, oh, it's probably important. If it's 17 times, it is 17 times more likely to go to the elite level, to get to the elite level in the future because they went to the competition when they were young, international competition, that changes how much effort should be put into sending these athletes to the competition.
Without a doubt, and it's, it costs a lot of money to get them, sometimes they're traveling all over the world, so it costs a lot of money. So, but yeah, it's worth, I think it's important that you don't just throw them in the deep end and send them off to a competition like that, but they need to be supported, and they need to be supported in terms of what the expectations are for them as well, especially at a young, if they're competing at a young age, they're young within their age group as well. It might be that they're a bit light in their body category as well, but it's that experience, and it's just making sure that the athletes are bought into that and on board with it, that no, you might not be going this time to medal, but it's about the experience and just soaking up that experience at a young age, because that's gonna be a bit of a game changer down the line. And then some of the other ones that we had, so we talked about the flexibility, so nearly 9 times more likely to make it if they're doing just half an hour of flexibility training a week at age 14. So it's not, you know, it's not a ridiculous amount. It's sensible. It involves a lot of injury prevention as well. And it's not, you know, it's not by any means unachievable, but coaches need to be bought in. Coaches and athletes need to be bought into that as well.
Yeah.
And it's, so you know, it's something that they can start as they start doing it, at least, you know, by sort of 12 years old, you just build it into your practice habits, don't you?
Yeah.
So yeah, not unachievable at all. And then we've talked about competition. So in terms of these, we talked a little bit about whole practice of the clean and jerk. So they're 8 times more likely to make it if they were doing over about if about a fifth of their training. So again, it's not unachievable, but about a fifth of the training they're doing needs to be of the clean and jerk as a whole, not just breaking it down into its constituent parts. You know, you see a lot of athletes just doing their sort of half cleans, just the jerk independently. But it's important that they're also doing that movement as a whole as well. And coaches were quite within the pathway. There were some really interesting discussions, because they don't always agree on these things. And one of the performance director had been trying to get some of the national team coaches to do a bit more whole practice. So this gave them some really nice evidence to support that, as opposed to just saying, you know, we think you should be doing this. It was a bit more grounded in science, which was nice. So that was one of the more exciting takeaways. And then in terms of anxiety specific practice, you'll see in the paper that we've actually got 2 measures of that. So one of the, I think from an applied point of view, Alex, people probably don't need to worry too much about that. I think you just take the applied take-home message, which is that you need to be building in some sort of psychological stress into practice, as long as that's sort of matched with support as well. So we've got something about the actual hours, and then we've got something about proportions of overall practice as well. So you can see there, athletes were 9 times or 8.5 times more likely to reach that elite status if they were doing a certain amount of hours of anxiety specific training. And in terms of proportions, that looked like about 10%. So the reason we've got both of those measures in there is just that you know it might be that if you get just a proportion now in terms of 9%, what does that look like in terms of their actual hours? I guess that could be skewed if they're not doing many hours. So it just enables us to look at that a little closer. But as I said, from an applied point of view, it's just really important that the coaches and athletes are building in some sort of psychological pressure training, I suppose, from sort of at least the age of 15 onwards. So once they've specialized in the sport, we know that weightlifting is quite a high stress sport psychologically. When you're on the platform, you're lifting, you're lifting in front of a big crowd. It's just you can't get away from that. So we need to make sure that athletes are prepared to deal with that psychological pressure, but also supported to be able to deal with that as well. You can't just go and throw in a whole load of pressure training into practice without making sure athletes are supported. So if you're thinking about, if you're a coach or an athlete thinking about, okay, well, what does that actually look like in practice? How do I go about doing that? It might be just simple things like trying to replicate the competition environment a little bit in practice. Like, you're never going to replicate it to the extent of, you know, the Commonwealth Games or a big competition, but just simple things like, how often in your practice are you literally doing, you know, warming up, doing your preparation, and then just doing your 3 snatches and your 3 clean and jerks. You know, you might be able to do that with a training partner. You might be able to do that with a group of you in the gym. You could do that on your, you know, there's no reason why you can't do that on your own as well. Set some targets. If you want to take it a step further, you might put some consequences on that as well if you don't hit your targets. So you can be quite innovative about how you go about that, and you know, have those conversations with with other people and a coach, but just some sort, it might be sort of kit washing, that's another typical one as well, but just some sort of inducing some sort of psychological pressure into practice as well. And we see, you know, if you watch the Commonwealth Games in Birmingham this summer, then so it was quite stressful to watch. Like, there's so many instances where athletes have sort of missed their first two lifts potentially, either on the, well, it's even worse on the snatch, because then you're at risk of bombing out of the whole competition, and that happened a few times. But you know, then it doesn't get more pressure than that in terms of that one lift. You make the lift, or you know, if you don't make the lift, you bomb out of the whole competition. You know what you've been training for years, and it all comes down to one lift. And there were some incredible sort of clutch performances when athletes would make that lift, but there was also some incidents where athletes would bomb out as well. And those, you know, it wasn't even a weight that for them that was particularly heavy. It's just that psychological impact. So any preparations you can do to get ready for that, then and the better. And you know, as we show there from a young age as well, from sort of 15 onwards.
Okay, so that's anxiety specific practice. One more attribute to discuss is total weightlifting related practice. And could you define how it was defined in the study, so we have a clarity?
Yeah, so in the study we also looked at, you know, other sports that athletes were doing, so where they were doing, you know, football, cross country, whatever it is, but this practice was specifically in terms of sort of what they did in the gym. So it might have been there bar work, so anything in terms of the Olympic lifts, snatch, clean, jerk. It might have been some sort of accessory work, so anything, you know, it might just be some squats or shoulder presses, whatever they were doing in terms of weight training in the gym. And then any that also included any sort of flexibility, mobility work as well. So any work they did in the gym that didn't include your other sports, so your football, your basketball, whatever, you know, whatever else it was, just the sort of the weightlifting specific weightlifting related training. So and what we saw with that is that, you know, from a young age, so from 11, 12 onwards, the athletes were six times more likely to make it to elite status if by 11, 12 they're already doing sort of an hour and a half to training in that sport. And you know, in the scientific literature, there's lots of literature about the importance of early sampling in terms of other sports and being cautious of early specialization. But what we see here is it's important not necessarily to specialize too early, but you need to engage in the sport early, engage in some sort of strength training early as well. And then for those athletes that don't go on to make it or reach that elite level, or maybe maybe jump to other sports, then A, it's set them up well in terms of those real sort of fundamental movement skills, in terms of moving well and in injury prevention. So it's set them up well for other sports, and also just generally in terms of moving well in life, which is really important. So it's not just about the athletes that go on to make it to elite status.
What coaches should take out of it, why it's important, and what would be the main message for coaches and athletes?
Yeah, brilliant. So in terms of the main message, like, coaches, when they look at this data, they're always very keen to use this in terms of their talent identification protocols. So you know, as with any sport, weightlifting gets limited amount of funding, and they need to use that money strategically in terms of what athletes are funded and whatnot. So our advice would be to not use that as an identification tool, but use it as a development tool. So in terms of though, and you know, that goes for the athlete, but also the wider pathway as well. So what can coaches be building into the pathway from a young age in terms of the type of training? And it's also important that coaches look at the pathway as a whole. We can't look at development and performance. They're not mutually exclusive. You know, sometimes coaches look at them as almost separate ends of the pathway that operate independently of each other, but they don't. What you do at a young age, you know, we're seeing here what you're doing at the age of 10 onwards, even sometimes younger, is really influencing, you know, future senior level performance. So you need to look at the pathway holistically. And weightlifting's a real culprit as well in their talent ID. They do a lot of the anthropometric and physiological, have a lot of anthropometric measures in terms of their protocols. So it's maybe a stepping away to look at talent identification development a little bit more holistically. So you also need to look at the what practice looks like as well, and then some of the psychological elements which haven't been focused on in this study, but we have done with weightlifting, that's also really important. So it's not just about limb length and height. It's much more talent is much more multifaceted than that. You know, expertise development begins young, so we need to be building in that competition experience young. And supporting athletes with it's not just throwing them in the deep end of competition, but supporting them to deal with the pressure. Flexibility training begins with young. And then from a coaching point of view, it's just being a bit cautious. Coaches are always really keen to break down the clean and jerk especially, but the snatch as well in terms of its constituent parts. So, you know, in terms of the half clean squats, in terms of the jerk on its own, but it's also remembering to make sure that at least sort of 20% of practice is doing the whole movement as well. And we had some really interesting conversations with the weightlifting coaching team, because the performance director was actually quite keen to implement a lot more sort of whole practice into training, but some coaches were a bit cautious of doing that. But this study has just given them the data to be able to support that as well, so that coaches aren't forget, especially at the senior levels, to be building in that whole practice as well. And it just, you know, links with the representative practice design that we talked about earlier in the conversation, in terms of making sure the practice environment is matched to that of competition. So hopefully this will just allow coaches to, you know, invest their funding a bit more strategically and ensure that the pathways are offering optimal development opportunities for athletes.
Well, it looks like Olympic weightlifting practice, but strength and weightlifting practice in general, it's a good basis for any sport and good base for life. So it will not be wasted. Whatever will be invested in these young athletes will
exactly. Yeah. And it's quite common for athletes to, you know, to jump across to other sports, and you know we see that a lot. And just in terms of teaching them those fundamental movement skills to move well is so important. You know, weightlifting sometimes gets a bit of a bad reputation about, you know, people are worried that with young people it's going to stunt their bone growth, and we see here all sorts of rubbish, which we know in the science is just not accurate now. So yeah, without a doubt, it's not just about those that make it. It's, you know, it gives athletes a solid base for moving into other sports as well, or just, you know, just for life.
So usually I make for the authors and for everyone to enjoy also an infographic of a study, so just a visual representation of what the paper is talking about, and I try to make them in a color that the authors will enjoy. So I wanted to ask you, what is your favorite color?
Got to be blue, color of the sea. Yeah.
Okay, noted. So that
that's very kind of you.
This paper will be in blue. Okay, last question, where people can find you if they want to ask question or just connect or follow your work, where they should find you?
Yes, great. Well, firstly, I suppose it's important to say this was a collaborative project with Weightlifting Wales, funded by CARES, and then with co-authors Dior Anderson and Gavin Lawrence as well. So I think you know, you should have on the paper, I think Dior was the corresponding author. Actually, no, I think I was actually. So my email will be on that paper because I was the corresponding author.
Yes.
And then on Twitter is a nice way to get in touch as well. So at @GotWaldVicky, and then you should also be able to find Dior Anderson on Twitter, and then Gav Lawrence, I think he's Sportside Gav, so you can find the other authors on Twitter as well and just reach out to them. But yeah, Twitter or email is absolutely fine.
Thank you so much, Vicky. I had some technical difficulties and you stood by, so thank you so much for your time today and your knowledge. Thank you.
No, that's great. Thank you for inviting me.